Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are brothers. Paul Mercier is an award-winning Irish playwright. He was the founder of the Passion Machine Theatre Company in the 80s, creating an environment that fostered the talents of many actors and writers, including Brendan Gleeson and Roddy Doyle, and brought theatre to new audiences. Though originally from Dublin, where he also taught as a younger man, he now lives in Connemara, where he writes full-time. His younger brother Mel also left Dublin, in his case to study music at UCC, as a mature student, and he never left. Nowadays, he's head of the School of Music at the University. He currently lives in West Waterford and combines his academic career with his career as a musician and composer. He's just been nominated for a prestigious Tony Award for sound design on the Broadway production of Colm Tobin's play The Testament of Mary. And as the winners will be announced at a glitzy do in New York tonight, we're meeting prior to his departure for the Big Apple. You're both very welcome.
Thank you very much.
So listen, are you looking forward to going to the Tony Awards?
I am looking forward to going to the Tony Awards. Yeah, I'm delighted. I've never been before. Mm-hmm. I kind of procrastinated about it for a while, about whether I would or not, would or would not go, because I'm not expecting to win. But in the end, I decided I'd go because I may never get the invitation again. And also because it seems to be the easiest way to deal with everybody saying to me, sure, you have to go. Why wouldn't you go? So in the end, I'm going.
But look, you already got the Drama Desk Award, which is another big award for it. So why are you so sure you won't win?
Well, I believe I won't win because...
Yeah, go on.
Okay. No. Well, first of all, I would never say I was going to win anyway.
Okay.
Because that's the best way to manage my
expectations.
That's the best way to manage my expectations.
Yeah.
I didn't expect to get a Tony nomination, and I have been sort of cultivating with myself this idea that that's enough.
So you won't be disappointed?
Oh, no, absolutely won't be disappointed. But actually, I've also discovered that, unfortunately, less than half of the Tony voters got to see the show before it closed. Which means that if you were actually a betting man, that you probably wouldn't put your money on me winning it.
But in a way, that takes the pressure off, doesn't it?
It does take the pressure off.
Yeah.
It means
that's,
I can just go and enjoy
it. It's a good place to be in, I have to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's right. Are you wearing a tuxedo?
He is now.
Yeah,
nice,
not a goon at all.
I tell you what I'm wearing.
Good.
I can tell you exactly what I'm wearing. I took it out of the wardrobe the other day. I'm going to wear the what we used to call a monkey suit that I bought when I was in Cork. I bought it in 1986 to wear to sing in choir. I was singing in the UCC choir and in Madrigal 75 in Cork. And I bought the monkey suit to wear for that. And I took it out the other day and it still fits me, which I'm not sure that's a good or a bad thing. But anyway, it fits me. And I'm going to wear a dicky bow that my friend Mary Hickson, who's the CEO of Cork Opera House, came to the opening night in New York. And she gave me an opening night present of this very flamboyant dicky bow.
Colour?
Multicoloured. My friends was asking me the other day that, you know, when you're on the red carpet, people will be saying, so what are you wearing? And I'll have to look inside the... I think I bought the monkey suit from a higher place.
Fine.
So, you know, I don't know what it is. You know, John Murphy's dress hire, 1986, Patrick Street in Cork.
It sounds like he's going to look splendid, Paul.
Yes, he will. Mel always looks splendid. Always, no matter what he's wearing, as you can see. We're all incredibly proud of him because, to explain, Mel, this is actually more for sound design, isn't it?
Yeah.
And which is a fascinating nomination, really. I mean, apart from the fact that Mel's so musical, but it's for sound design. But also, I think it's also because he was dealing with some extraordinary technology when putting the piece together.
Yeah, I was there for 6 weeks working on the show. I had recorded lots of wonderful musicians before I went over there. That's tends to be the way that I work. So I'll go into the studio, I'll gather sounds. I won't make anything before I go. And then I always think of it like I bring a palette of sounds with
yes.
me, of colours. And then when I'm in the space then, once the lighting starts to come together and the piece starts to come together, that's when I start to paint in sound. I can only do it in the room. I can't make it beforehand. And in fact, most of the work happens in the week before the show opens, which is very risky. It really is risky. You've got to improvise. But it's the only way that I feel I can actually make the music and the sound world for the actual piece that's being made rather than the script or the play. Because, of course, the journey from the script to the actual production is a great one. And I found that over time, if I made things and they were over-prepared, here's a tune I made for this bit and this bit.
Yeah, it might work as well.
Well, it never works, actually.
But you have to have the technology around them. And you have to be patient too.
You have to be patient. I had a wonderful, wonderful. I had a wonderful associate sound designer, a New York guy, who put together the sound system for me. Yeah.
But Paul, as a playwright, is there a purity to the play and to the script, and then someone like Mel comes along as a sound design? Is that complimentary?
Oh yeah. Well, I've worked with Mel, and he's done things, and I just love the way he can actually add to what you're doing and create an ambience or. That's the word.
Ambience. That's a good
word. But as a playwright, is the word not the most important thing?
Not necessarily. No. In the tradition that we work in, the literary theatre tradition, the word has been venerated, yes, to the point where other forms of theatrical expression have not been maybe developed as they should. Anything from singing to dance to mime. To all those other forms, they are valid, and they are very, very important forms of communication too. What's great about the sound design as opposed to music is sound design isn't actually to the ordinary ear is not actually music. It's this sound that's there.
Mm. It's essentially collaboration. And if you have a director like Paul or other directors that I've worked with who are interested in sound and who realise the potential of it, and crucially, if you have an actor or actors on stage who like to work with sound,
yes,
that makes a huge difference. So I've done a lot of work with Fiona Shaw, and Fiona is intensely musical herself. Mm. And when we get into a groove together, when it really starts to fly, it feels like a duet. And this is so the Testament is a one-woman show, and it feels like you're in a kind of duet with her, which is wonderful. And she, of course, she loves the company of the sound on the stage.
And you've worked with Fiona, haven't you? And Deborah Warner, obviously, who she's so close to and worked so closely with before, haven't you?
Yeah, I didn't know who Fiona Shaw was or who Deborah Warner was back in 2000, but I got a phone call out of the blue in Cork from Deborah Warner asking me if I'd meet her in the Imperial Hotel. And I went to meet her, and at the time...
Did you Google her before you went?
I didn't. I don't think... Could you Google then?
You
did, man. You Googled her.
Just to see who she was.
I'm not even sure you could Google then. But anyway,
Did you know who she was?
No, but you see, I asked people who she was. I met her and we had a cup of coffee and we talked about the challenges of this. How do you create sound in a space where you also have the spoken word? And how do you make that work? And we had a long conversation. I think by the end of the conversation, we kind of realised you can't do it. And then she asked me if I would write the music for a production of Medea, which she and Fiona were making at the Abbey at the time. Since that time, we did that, and that was very successful. So I've actually done every so-called straight play with Deborah that she's done since that time. Now, Deborah does a lot of opera as well. But there are other composers involved in that already, so there's no room for me.
But the nice thing this morning is you're going to play live for us, both of you, accompanied by two other people who I will name check in a moment. But first up, you're going to play a selection of jigs. Tell me about this.
Well, the first one is called The Cliffs of Moher.
Right.
And that's for all the McGanns in Clare.
Yeah.
They're your mum's relations.
Yeah. One of whom is a fine flute player, Gerard McGann. Right. And the other one is Old John's jig.
And you're playing mandola.
Mandola.
Which is correct. A beautiful instrument. Explain what it is. It's the daddy of the mandolin.
It is, yes. Yeah. I thought it was the other way around, but actually it predates the mandolin.
And Mel, you're playing the baron?
I'm playing the baron in this one, yeah.
And we're going to take these jigs. And you're accompanied now by Fiacra O'Corrigan and Geraldine O'Callaghan.
They're playing fiddle and concertina.
Off you go. That was fantastic. Wakes us all up on this Sunday morning. Where did all the music come from in your family, Paul?
I think Mel can correct me here now because he will. So I'll just begin.
Okay. Right.
But my understanding is Dad would have come to the music a little later on in life, and came to the Bowron and came to traditional music very late in his life. You're talking about 40s. And when he came to it with such a passion and spontaneity and like a child, to be honest with you. He was very close to Eamon de Butler and got involved with Ciol Tóirí Chulainn and Seán Ó Riada. And then that morphed or evolved into the Chieftains and so forth.
And he played the Bataran.
He played the Bataran and he played the bones as well. But there were other influences as well, I would say. Our mother, you know, just adores jazz, and that's her passion. And our older brother Peter brought the guitar into the house. He was the man who taught me my first chords, you know.
For him.
And in a way that has passed on to Val, who's a super guitar player.
That's right, and singer.
Right. And so with such a family, large family, there were just so many other influences coming into the house. So that all the phase of music since the 60s was just hitting the house, coming in from different members of the family. So I would consider that as the general influence.
That's right.
Ten children, there are 10 of you, aren't there?
Yes.
There are 10, yeah, that's right. All listening to their own music, actually, at the time. And all of us tuning in to Top of the Pops. We were full of pride at the time when Daddy was with Oireachtas and Ceolthóirí Chulainn and with the Chieftains, because you felt that you were at the beginning of something very significant happening. Mm-hmm. We really felt at the time, although I'm not sure we called it that at the time, that we were in the middle of this kind of revival period. So it was very exciting. And when the Chieftains, for example, went on Top of the Pops, I think they played The Morning Dew on it. And then we saw them on the Old Grey Whistle Test. I think that's really when that's when sort of all the different influences started to come together for us. We began to think, okay, this is not actually separate. This is all part of what is a kind of natural, kind of diverse sound world for us.
We just said, actually, this is more about music, ethnic music and world music and everything happening at that time. I think that's where Mel took up the baton. You know, in a way, because he's been all over the world since. He's been to Java, he's been to Ghana. Ghana.
Ghana, yeah.
He's been to India. So that's where it's really gone quite strong.
And how did you end up playing with your dad? Your dad was Pather, wasn't he?
That's
he was probably
right.
the first professional Bowron player in the world, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, well, if the Chieftains were the first professional traditional Irish traditional music group, then my father was definitely the first professional Bowron player. In the early days, you see, what was great for us was that Daddy was involved in Chieftains 2, 3, 4 and 5, those albums. And I think after the second or third album, they started to record in London. And I think that was also quite a new thing for an Irish band to go to London to go into a studio there. Daddy would come home with the first pressing of the LP, which had no label on it. It might have been, I think they would come in a white LP case and put it on our record player. And we'd sit and listen, and we found huge excitement to hear it, because at that time, I think particularly, every album the Chieftains made was new and fresh, and they were breaking new ground all of the time. And so we'd be the first to hear that. Also, we think anyway, we were the first to have a stereo record player on our road. So some of our friends would come in to listen. And Daddy, who was fascinated with the stereo thing, he'd have those recordings at the time, which would have a train passing across your room from one side to the other.
Ping ball.
Going from one side.
We would listen. I'd literally sit listening to ping ball as if it was a piece of music.
That's right. And Daddy would sit us down so that we'd be right in the middle of the two speakers.
That's right.
Sitting behind each other. In a line behind.
So he understood the importance of sound.
He absolutely did. Paul took to the Bowron as well, and I took to it and kept playing. And I had the fantastic opportunity of sitting down with Daddy to practice some of the new rhythms that he'd be learning and practicing for a new album that they were making. So I got to sit at home and do that with Dad, which was great. So we got at that time to sort of develop a very informal duet.
Yes.
And then one day, I think it was 1979, the phone rang. Daddy was finished with the Chieftains at that stage. The phone rang, and John Cage, the American composer, was on the phone, and said, "I'm in Ireland, and I'm making recordings for a piece called Roratorio, an Irish circus on Finnegan's Wake.
Yes.
Will you come in and play?" And my father said, "I will. Can I bring my son Mel?" We didn't know who John Cage was now at the time.
No idea.
We didn't know who he was.
A guy came up to me in UCD and says, "Do you know John Cage?" He was from the music department.
He cornered me.
I had no idea.
Mm. That's right.
But that was the beginning.
Daddy and I then had, we toured with this, with Roratorio for over 10 years across the world with Paddy Glacken and Liam O'Flynn and Joe Heaney, a wonderful Shannon singer, and Seamus Tansey. Actually, the real privilege of that was that I got to see my father as an adult as well. In other words, I saw him amongst his peers. That was
very important for Dad at that stage, because Mel became his musical companion. at that stage in his life, because he was going into, I suppose, in phase three.
That's
at
right.
that point. So Mel was there for that. And I do think in one respect, you kind of rejuvenated and kept the...
Yeah.
Great company for him at that stage.
Yeah, and great company for me. We developed a great friendship as well.
Did it mean you were the closest to him of all the 10 children?
I suppose I was the one who shared closely his musical life.
He was away, you know, and you were there with him at that time.
True.
So that was very important, you know.
Listen, we're going to listen. You mentioned earlier, I think, Morning Dew, which
yeah,
is one of
right.
the Chieftains' pieces that I think you said you saw it on Top of the Pops at one stage.
I think we saw it, Morning Dew. And this is one we used to listen to on the stereo because it's one of the ones where you get the great effect of two barons and playing together. One's going dilly-dum, the other's going dilly-dum, dilly-dum, dilly-dum.
Which one was your dad?
He was the dilly-um.
Okay, well, I'm going to listen now for the Dillium part, because that is Pater Mercier with the Chieftains' Morning Dew. Morning to you there, the Chieftains, your dad, Pather, of course, playing the Baron. He loved writing poetry as well, didn't he?
He did. He loved language. He loved the Irish language. He loved the English language. And he was very eloquent in his own speech. It was a significant part of his charm, I think. Mm-hmm. And he loved to write. And he would write on the back of a beer mat or, you know, he'd write.
Yes, when Dad went away, there's usually what he would come home with is the... The do not disturb card from the hotel.
Right.
He would give it to you, or the sick bag from the airplane.
Right.
Great. And a poem, as Mel says, that could have been written on anything.
Written on anything. So he'd write them, and we have a lot of his poetry, if not all of it. And in most cases, he's kind of put a little note about when and where it was written. So this is a small little poem of his called "The Friendly Match," which was written in April 1976, and all it says is airborne to San Francisco. So this would probably been written on a flight when Daddy was on tour with the Chieftains in America, and I guess when you could still smoke on an airline flight. So it's called "The Friendly Match." The friendly match, when struck, will light a candle at the dead of night, or light a fag when nerves are frayed, or the fire for the kitchen maid. God knows kitchen maids are few and friendly matches fewer too. The box design, the size unchanged, the price and number rearranged to meet the cost of living and dying too. The friendly match will help you through the shorter span of smoking to eternity.
Great. Because your dad was a huge influence in your lives, obviously, but your mum, who's still alive, obviously remains a huge influence in your lives.
Yeah, absolutely. We look back in awe at how Mammy and Daddy managed to bring up 10 of us and feed us. Sometimes there was probably some money around, and then other times I think there probably wasn't any money around. And yet they managed to do that.
And educate you all.
And educate us all. And I think that Mammy is an extraordinary manager.
Dad was married twice. His first wife, Joan, died. And he had two children by that. That's Francis, who's the eldest, and Peter. And then what happened was when he met Mam, our mother, I'm the eldest, Mel comes after me, and then the other six after that. So in a way, it was an extraordinary, as you say, in terms of management and in terms of engaging with...
Yeah.
It's like managing a small company, really.
I mean, managing with love, of course. You know, the family is very close, And I think perhaps that, more than anything, is a testament to the love that we got from Mammy and Daddy.
Yeah. Your dad died when? About 91, was it?
He died in September, September the 6th, 1991.
And was
that... He was 76.
And was that a loss you both dealt with well or found difficult?
I would be honest, I dealt with it okay because I felt he had a very fulfilling life. That was my feeling. I felt that maybe he died too young, but...
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a...
He died suddenly. He died of a heart attack.
So in that respect, you know, it wasn't... It was.
We weren't expecting it at all.
Not at all.
In fact, he was out playing snooker one evening with a friend of his.
Another of his great passions.
Yeah, he loved playing snooker. He just loved... Even if he only potted one ball all night, he just loved it.
Yeah. And he'd watch it all night on the TV as well.
That's right. It was kind of heyday of snooker, wasn't it? Alex Higgins and all those ones.
Yeah.
I'd go down and play with him sometimes. And I was actually fortunate to have been home for about 3 months in the house. I was the only one at home with Mum and Dad. Everyone else had moved on at that stage. And I was back from America. I had a lovely summer of watching Daddy in the garden and playing a little bit of snooker, having the tea with them, you know, which the image I always have is of the tomatoes he took out of the one of the many glass houses that he'd pull off. They were ripening. Do you remember, Paul? He'd have them on. They'd be ripening on the windowsill. And
there were tomatoes everywhere. And the hot press would be full of tomatoes.
That's right.
Everything, yeah.
And
yeah,
then...
It was great. He loved gardens. See, many years ago... I think it was the 40s or 50s, he worked as the warden of a hostel.
That's right.
The hostel, and he would do the garden of the hostel. And in later in life, at the time when now Mel is talking about, your dad had, it was like a surrogate gardener. He had gardens in other people's back gardens on the road, and he had vegetables growing in different, and he could walk literally into anybody's garden.
It's almost
like there were no such thing as boundaries at all.
Great.
And he would come back.
And he never left the house without a plant to give to someone.
Yeah,
it was always just amazing. Bringing plants or flowers from his garden when he went out visiting.
So do either of you garden? Have you followed that?
I love gardening. Yeah, I don't have the time as much. If I was if you offered me any other existence, I would love to do gardening. To be honest with you, I just think it's
really
wonderful.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Love growing things. So our mother has a fabulous garden.
Yeah.
She's a great gardener. And at this point in time now, she's every year she goes through the anxiety of hoping that the blooms will conspire to happen at the time she wants them to happen. And
so she shows us. She shows
she
her
shows
garden,
the garden
for charity for the Laura Lynn.
Oh, fantastic. Hospice, yeah.
When Daddy's garden was full of vegetables, it was packed. And this is a small, small suburban garden that Daddy managed to build 4 glass houses in by hand. I mean, none of these were shop-bought glass houses. He made them from bits of glass and bits of wood. I mean, they were extraordinary.
He got them when he was working in Crampton's.
Yeah.
And they were demolishing in the 60s and so on, demolishing some Victorian houses to build places like the American Embassy and so on. He would be bringing home windows and masonry
and
everything, recycle the whole thing and build glass houses out the back with them.
Interestingly, Mammy didn't spend that much time in the garden then. It was really Daddy's domain. But after Daddy died, little by little, Mammy transformed the garden into a flower garden. And now it's a riot of flowers, actually, at the moment.
And loads of colour and everything.
Beautiful colour, which she shows. It's beautiful.
It's nice, though, Paul, because you all grew up, I think, in Blackrock and Dublin, but you have gone back to live in Connemara, haven't you?
Every day I pass where Dad went, he was called Padder Agawa, Padder of the Blacksmith, because he stayed with the blacksmith there just on Shrohan on the bay. So, you know, I'm acutely aware of that and acutely aware of the impact that had on him and how that really changed his life. But then, you know, when you're living there, it's a different experience as well.
Is it a great experience?
It's a wonderful experience. But it's not just the language, it's also the people and it's the landscape. And both have been very good to us. And it's challenging. I might have left Dublin, but I'm still very much Dublin. You know, I'll never be anything else. I'll never be.
Do you speak Irish or English in your home?
I would be mixed.
A lot of families are like that.
But it was always, we would be the generation that, you know, sent the children to Gaelscoil and so on. And then we followed through by going down to Carrow and they went to school and there and through.
Because you made that T.G. Cahir series, didn't you, Africa, about the experiences almost of children
actually,
going through
that's true, yeah. And that was a great experience. But I found that a very rewarding experience because I always had a thing about the language. You see, my relationship with the language is very kind of, look, I'm not a native speaker. I don't dream in that language, you know. But at the same time, it was always a great passion for me to do something that could in any way promote the language. And ideally, what we wanted to do was to create a series whereby a teenager would walk in at tea time, having come from school, and themselves put the TV on to watch something in Irish and not be asked to do it as if it were educational or in their best interest. That it was something that they could identify with. And that ultimately is what we wanted to do.
I love that line that you don't dream in Irish, but you studied Irish and you were an Irish teacher. Were you an Irish teacher in Greendale?
I was, yeah.
That's an amazing skill. I mean, remind people.
You know, Greendale was just an extraordinary experience and a terrific school and a terrific area. Yeah. But sure, it doesn't exist anymore. It's gone now. So it's a great loss, you know. But it made a huge impact.
Yeah.
You know, as a public school or as a community school, if ever there was the model school, that was it.
You gave up teaching, Paul, didn't you, to go into the theatre full time to write?
I did, yes.
Do you miss it?
Teaching.
Yeah.
I miss Greendale and okay. I miss Kilbarrick. I can't say, put my hand on my heart, if I could cope with teaching. I think it's a tough job. But I loved where I was. I loved it.
Was it during the time that you set up the Passion Machine Theatre Company that you were still teaching?
Yes.
But that must have been almost impossible because...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we finish school and then go in and do rehearsals and then you'll be rehearsing all weekend and then you go back to school. Now, I had the energy for it. And also, I have to say that not so much the inspiration, but definitely the work that I was doing at the time was in some way connected to what I was doing in school or the people I was in, the world I was engaging with to some extent. So it was all the one thing for me. I don't know, it was a long time ago in one sense. But then, you know, there was a point where you kind of say, it's like the traditional music, you kind of say, am I going to do this professionally? I never actually saw myself using the word professional as a thing. In fact, it was a long time before I would even accept that I was actually, a playwright. What did you do? My answer was, I teach.
That's right.
Because I felt comfortable with that. And I would still say, I'm an ex-teacher.
You're a playwright.
But it's just one of those things. You don't see it that way.
Is it a lack of confidence almost that you can't say, I am a playwright? Mm.
Yeah, perhaps a lack of confidence. Yeah.
But what is nice for people who don't know much about the Passion Machine Theatre Company, certainly for younger generations who mightn't remember it. I know Brendan Gleeson, the now world famous actor, was part of it. And speaking recently, I noticed at the Dáil Committee on Arts, Sport, Tourism, he actually said, and I quote, I started my acting career with the Passion Machine Theatre Company, which was established to bring theatre to new areas. It was all about inclusion. It sought to bring theatre to people who would not normally think of theatre as of anything to do with them. Artistically, the company explored and reflected people's lives. And he goes on to say how uplifting it was. So if you did nothing else in your life, what a tribute that you set up that company with others uplifting.
Yeah, well, privileged to be being with people like that. I mean, Brendan at the time was teaching. He was out Darndale way. That's what he was. And he was coming in for rehearsals as well as his other activities like Gaelic football and so forth.
Well, look, we're going to take another piece of music live. Tell me about this.
Yeah, this is a piece that is in the Great Book of Ireland, which was recently purchased by University College Cork. And in the Great Book of Ireland, it's mostly poetry and artists working together. But there are 9 or 10 composers as well who were invited by Theo Dorgan to put some music in as well. And for the launch of the Book of Ireland in Cork, I asked Fiacra if he would take a look at the short piece of music in the book written by Jim Lockhart and make an arrangement or an interpretation of it, which he did. And then he's added on another tune at the end of it. At the time we thought, let's add another tune from the O'Neill collection to bring it home. So he's added a tune called The Top of Cork Road. So it's really Fiacra's interpretation, Fiacra O'Carrigan, of Jim Lockhart's piece in the Great Book of Ireland.
Beautiful piece of music written by Jim Lockhart and arranged, of course, by Fiacra, who's here with us. First of all, we're going to take another piece of music, which is a collaboration between you and Micheál O'Sullivan, obviously a colleague of yours in Cork. How did you end up in UCC in the first place, Mel?
I ended up in UCC because I had been playing with Micheál since I was a teenager and indeed did Paul. And in my mind, I never thought that I could maybe have a career in music or indeed that I would go on to do a music degree. And so I went another direction entirely. I went to Kevin Street to do electronics, went to work for a French telecommunications company for 3 years. So I spent a couple of years working for the Simon community in Dublin and in the Anna Liffey Centre in Dublin. And then one night I was in a pub. I was watching the Late Late Show and I see Micheál. I'm not even sure I could hear it, but I see Micheál playing, and I think Tommy Hayes, the Bowron player Tommy Hayes, or Colin Murphy, the Cork Bowron player. And I saw them playing together, and suddenly something kind of, a switch went on. I thought, my God, maybe I could go to Cork to study music, because I'd begun to hear these, there were kind of rumours around that in Cork now you could go and do a music degree as a traditional Irish musician. Now, I was slow enough even to put myself in that category, because I was a Bowron player. I never particularly thought of myself as a musician at the time. I went to Cork then to do a BMUS for 3 years. And of course, Micheál was there doing wonderful work, really opening up the curriculum and inviting in traditional music and traditional musicians. And so I suppose in a way I was the first Bowron and Bones player to do a music degree. And I had a wonderful time. I really loved it in Cork. I had a huge appetite at that stage. I suppose I was 26 at the time. I had a huge appetite for everything that was going on. I continued to work with Micheál. We started to play more together, to make recordings together. And I got involved in the student societies, and I sang in the choir, and I had a voracious appetite, actually, for everything that was going on.
Probably because you went there late.
I think absolutely.
Think that,
yeah. Oh, no, I think it was absolutely because I went there late.
He went late on his own steam.
And I went on my own steam. And I went there with the support of Mam and Dad. When I graduated in from Cork in 1989, I got a Fulbright scholarship and I went to L.A. And I did a master's degree in L.A. And that's where I discovered a whole other world of music. I discovered West African drumming, Latin American music, North and South Indian music, Javanese gamelan. And I spent morning till night playing in a place called the California Institute of the Arts. And one of the things I brought back with me was this new interest in all different kinds of world music, not least Indian percussion. They have a language that they use to describe all of the syllables. So every sound on the drum has its own syllable, like da, din, tiri, kitta, da, which I was fascinated by, because as a Bowron player, all I knew was diddly-dum, diddly-diddly-diddly-dum. And I discovered this whole rich world. I came back, I sat on the floor with the tabla, and Micheál and I said, look, let's make something new together. So I sat on the floor and I composed these rhythm patterns, like tunes. So something like tirikitada, da tirikitada, da da tirikitada, tirikitada, da tirikitada, da da tirikitada. And that became the basis of the chorus for a tune called Must Be More Crispy. Micheál would call it kind of Hiberno jazz.
Fantastic, I love that. I was watching the two of you as well, though, when that was being played and you were chatting away to each other. You're very close. Were you close as young boys growing up?
Always, yeah.
Always, yeah. Did you share a bedroom?
We did, yeah.
With many others.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's the way.
We shared the same school, same football team.
Same friends.
But we definitely went on different trajectories for a period, and I think that was good. I think that was a good thing as well. But we have also worked together, and that has been great too.
And do you remain close today? Has your relationship changed since you were the little boys sharing the bedroom, Mel?
I think it has changed, but I can speak for myself and say that I've always known where Paul was.
Which is good.
And there's always been an emotional connection. So Paul was the one who really opened the door and the world of theatre, I think, for our whole family and for me. But he did it in a way that we all felt very connected to. So from the time that we were going to see all of his plays, Budleia, Home, Drowning, Studs, we'd often laugh. We'd always laugh at the shows, but we often cry as well, because we'd spend a long time then afterwards wondering, you know, was that me? Or I think, you know, I'd say, gosh, Ruth, I think that was you, or that was Daddy in there. So we felt very close to it. We felt emotionally very, very close. What I remember particularly about something like Studs, is that you have this extraordinarily dynamic style. I think at that I used to do some massage, some Swedish massage, and Paul used to bring me in.
I forgot about that.
Paul used to bring me in to massage the aching limbs of some of his actors. It was the choreography of them in something like Studs and in other work as well.
That was the one thing they looked forward to, was Mel giving
Mel's massages. Yeah.
That's right.
When are we going to get the massage? In fact, somebody said years later, you don't do massages anymore. The company had changed.
But he's your older brother.
Yes, very
by
much
a bit.
So, yeah.
How big an influence has he had on your life?
Oh, I think he's had a huge influence. What it comes down to is two things. Passion. Paul is incredibly passionate about everything he does. He's smiling there now, but he is.
He's a great smile.
And he's known for that passion. But it's a passion that's combined with a rigour. It is that combination of passion and rigour that makes him beloved of all the people that he has ever worked with. I always meeting people, actors over the years who've done work with Paul, and they hold him in the highest regard. I mean, they really do love him. Mm. And I think that has inspired me. Passion and rigour, attention to detail are also very, very important. Very, very important in my work. And also... he loves people. He loves people.
Well,
has
I'm
great
not as,
time
I'm not
for
as
people.
Gregarious as you are, Mel. That's Mel is the people person. That's for sure. He's a great man with people.
So well,
I'm the shy one, I have to say.
And your influence on your life from your brother Mel?
Well, it would be that gregariousness and that ability to communicate both within the family, but also in public as well. That's something I admire greatly, I have to say, and that he can do that both through his music, but also, you know, through his personality.
And do you find that hard sometimes?
Hard?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. That's not my... not something I'm absolutely comfortable with at all. Which is perhaps one of the reasons why I got involved in theatre, because then the actors express it, or I would much prefer not to have to say anything. I find it difficult. I always found difficulty doing interviews. Always difficulty talking about what I was doing. And in fact, I was more comfortable with just putting something on the stage and saying it that way, which is why I got involved in the first place.
If we're ever at a family occasion or any other kind of occasion, a theatre opening or anything like that, people gather around Paul. They always gravitate towards you because he actually communicates in spades. He's also very funny.
Who got the girls easier when you were younger?
He did. Absolutely.
What they fell for Mel, Paul.
Absolutely. He stole the show.
To be honest, I think neither of us were great at getting girls.
Well, look, you both ended up very happy with the women.
Well,
we both
got the girls.
Wanted in the end.
Absolutely. Between Maura and Anne, yes, absolutely.
But look, what's next? The Tony Award for you. Best of luck tonight.
Thank you very much.
And then what are you moving on to?
I'm going to do a play in the Dublin Theatre Festival with Annie Ryan, Desire Under the Elms. And then I'm going to New York again with Fiona Shaw in a production of The Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, directed by Phyllida Lloyd. That's in December.
And you, Paul, you're writing away. You don't like
to... I knew you were going to ask me this. But I am writing. I'm always writing. So, yeah. But I never say what I'm doing.
But look, best of luck tonight in
Thank
the Tony.
You very
we'll
much.
All be rooting
good luck,
for
man.
You.
Thanks.
And my thanks on sound today to Kieran Cullen, to my producer, Eileen Herron. You're going out playing live one more set of hornpipes, is it?
That's right.
Well, the first is the Stacky Nornan,
which we used to dance to in the Gaeltacht all the time. Léi mhéin, léi mhaoin.
That's for all Muintir Connemara now. And the other one, I don't know. I don't know what it is, actually.
Gone Anam.
Without a name. Listen, thank you both very much. Go over there now and you're going to play us out with these hornpipes.
Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.